conceptual setup about algebraic quantum gravity. And most of the time I will speak about the motivation to introduce algebraic quantum gravity. And the motivation comes out of the status of the semi-classical limit of loop quantum gravity. And I will introduce the master constraint program and explain how this could improve the status. And then I will discuss the differences between loop quantum gravity and algebraic quantum gravity. And in the second part, I will explain how one can do semi-classical analysis within the framework of algebraic quantum gravity. And in particular, I will discuss the semi-classical limit of the extended algebraic master constraint operator. And in the third part, which will be a bit more technical, I will explain what semi-classical perturbation theory is, what's the idea about it, and what's the application. And finally, I will conclude and state open problems. So the question, is general relativity contained in the semi-classical sector of loop quantum gravity? Yeah, it's very important and still not answered today because it's quite hard to answer, but it's the main motivation for introducing algebraic quantum gravity. So let me start with loop quantum gravity and the setup. So we have a given C star algebra of our quantum operators, and we use the GNS construction in order to find representations of this algebra. And as has been shown 2005 by Zalman, Lewandowski, Okolov, and Thiemann, if you assume that the state, the GNS state, is diffeomorphismic invariant, which is quite a physical assumption, you can get one representation of the algebra which is underlying loop quantum gravity. So we have a uniqueness result. And whenever you assume that a state in the GNS construction is invariant under a particular automorphism, you get automatically a unitary action of these automorphisms. In our case, it's the diffeomorphisms, and which act in a very natural way. So if you have a given spin network, they will just map the graph of the spin network to the image of the diffeomorphism. But it turns out that this action is not weakly continuous. And weakly continuous means if I consider the limit of the one parameter family of UTs of phis on the left-hand side, and I apply it to an arbitrary spin network living on a graph gamma prime, it should be equal to the right-hand side, which is just the unity operator acting on T of gamma prime. And so it's just the scalar product between T of gamma and T of gamma prime. And this should be valid for all spin network functions living in the Hilbert space. So if I choose in particular T of gamma equal to T of gamma prime, then I can find a U of T, which maps my T of gamma prime onto a graph which is disjoint with the T gamma, with the gamma graph. And then since spin network functions living on orthogonal graphs are living on disjoint graphs are orthogonal, the left hand side would be zero, but the right hand side is just if one, because I have T gamma and T gamma, so I can show there exist particular cases where this equality is not fulfilled. And then we say that such an action is weakly continuous. And a consequence of this is that we cannot implement the infinitesimal generators of the diffeomorphisms in our quantum theory. So it's quite a technical fact, but the consequences have some physical implication. And especially if we look at the Dirac algebra. The Dirac algebra is the algebra of constraints, loop quantum gravity, or of GR. If we take the Poisson bracket of two diffeomorphism constraints, we get a diffeomorphism constraint as well. So it's closed. If we take the Poisson algebra of a diffeomorphism constraint with a Hamiltonian constraint, we get a Hamiltonian constraint. But if we take the Poisson bracket between two Hamiltonians, we get something which is a diffeomorphism constraint, but it depends on the phase space point labeled by Q here. So in the first two cases, we have something which looks like structure constants, but in the third Poisson bracket, we have something which is phase dependent. So we would rather call this structure functions. And since the infinitesimal diffium of Hissman generators, which are in this algebra, cannot be represented in the quantum theory, we might have some problems to represent the algebra at all. And for the first two Poisson brackets, you can somehow use an exponentiated substitute. So if you take the finite diffium of Hissman, you will have this relation and can implement them in the quantum theory. What? Ah, sorry. Ah, cool. But as I mentioned already, for the third Poisson bracket, I have structure functions, so I won't have, I cannot just exponentiate the relation because it's not a true Lie algebra, and I will run into some problems. And one problem is that if I consider the Hamiltonian constraint, if I have the operator, I want somehow to quantize this without anomalies, and the third relation tells me the Poisson bracket of two Hamiltonian constraints will somehow be a diffium of Hissman. So if I'm in the quantum theory, I should implement the Hamiltonian operator in such a way that the commutator, which would correspond to the Poisson bracket, should somehow have to do something with the right-hand side in the classical theory. And an idea how this is done is that if you quantize the Hamiltonian operator and you take the commutator, you have to ensure that if you apply it to diffium of Hissman in varying states, it's annihilated by the commutator of the Hamiltonian, which would be the same for if we could implement the infinitesimal diffium of Hissman operator, it should annihilate diffium of Hissman in varying states as well. And you can do this, but it turns out you have to quantize the Hamiltonian operator in a graph-changing fashion, which means when it acts on a spin network, which lives on a given graph gamma, it will add additional edges to the graph. And another point is, in order to ensure that the commutator really annihilates diffium of Hissman in varying states, the action of the operator has to be defined quite locally. So this is also a criticism of the Hamiltonian operator which exists so far in loop quantum gravity. Since the whole dynamics of loop quantum gravity is encoded in the Hamiltonian constraint operator, we are interested in checking the semi-classical limit of the Hamiltonian constraint in order to say whether it's really general relativity what we have quantized. And at this point, it's extremely difficult to define coherent state for graph-changing operators for the following reason. So if I take a coherent state which is just defined on a given graph gamma, the so-called cutoff state, and I want to calculate expectation values of my operator within these states, this will be trivially zero because the H will add some additional edges to my graph gamma here, and then these two states are orthogonal, so I will get zero. Another idea is to use so-called shadow states, and then you sum over different cutoff states for different graphs, and you define a quite so-called generalized expectation value. So you have a cutoff graph here on the right-hand side, and you have a generalized shadow state on the left-hand side. So it's a coherent state which is defined on a given graph, gamma. And if you give me another graph, I have to define another coherent state on it. So it's a really graph-dependent state. And that's exactly one point. So if I add with the Hamiltonian operator another edge which does not belong to gamma here, in this framework there will be a graph on the left-hand side which contains this edge because I'm summing over several graphs. But it turns out that if I calculate expectation values of the basic variables, like, for instance, holonomies or loops or whatever, if I sandwich them between two coherent states, the semi-classical behavior is fine. But if I sandwich them between a one and a coherent state from the left-hand side, the semi-classical behavior is not fine. So it's not well approximated. And this is what happens in the case of shadow states. So at some point, the Hamiltonian will add an additional edge, which does not belong to my cutoff graph here. So it commutes. I can interchange the order of this cutoff graph on H, since the additional edge does not belong to gamma, and then I get terms like this. So even in the case of shadow states, the semi-classical behavior of graph-changing operators is not well approximated. So the conclusion is that more work has to be done in the case of graph-changing operators. So let me summarize the first arguments a bit. It seems that the semi-classical limit of loop quantum gravity and verifying the quantum algebra are very much interlinked. We saw that the assumption of spatially diffeomorphism invariance leads to not weakly continuous representations of the diffeomorphism. In order to get an anomaly free Hamiltonian with only finite diffeomorphisms, we have to quantize it in a graph changing fashion. And a graph changing Hamiltonian operator, for such operators, are no appropriate semi classical tools available today. So it seems somehow that we can't say anything about the semi classical limit. But an idea to improve this situation is the so called master constraint program. And in this program, you introduce a new constraint, the so-called master constraint, which is just the weighted sum of the squared versions of the single constraints. Here, it's the Gauss constraint, the diffeomorphism constraint, and the Hamiltonian constraint, weighted by the square root of q to the cube. And one can show that m equal to 0, I forgot the 0 here, is equivalent to the vanishing of the single constraint. So the constraint surface which is encoded in M is the same than the one which is encoded in the single constraint. Moreover, you choose the weighting such that M is spatially diffeomorphism invariant, which is not true for the single constraints. And a problem could be if you look at this expression and you see the squared version of the constraints, and the definition of a weak Dirac observable is that it commutes with the constraint on the constraint surface. So since I have the squared version of the constraints here, the Poisson bracket between any phase-based function, which I can differentiate one times, and the M constraint operator will vanish anyway, because I can move one constraint out of the Poisson bracket, which is zero on the constraint surface. So you have to, you could say, okay, M is not able to detect weak Dirac observables, but this is not true, because you can show that if you take if you take this Poisson bracket here, it's equivalent to the condition that O commutes with each of the C's on the constraint surface. And since we have only one constraint now, the constraint algebra trivially simplifies. It's just zero. And this is the main motivation that the problems I mentioned before maybe disappear, because we don't have such a complicated Dirac algebra anymore now. And there have been various examples calculated by Dietrich and Thiemann, where they applied the master constraint program, for instance, to finite systems, then to SL2R, and to free and interacting field theories. And in all these examples, it turned out, when they calculated the physical Hilbert space, which can be done in terms of direct integral decomposition, that the result you expected for these simple examples is exactly the same you would expect if you take the single constraints. So in all these examples, it seems to work. And if you actually quantize the master constraint in the framework of general relativity, there are two ways of quantizing it. One is the graph-changing way, similar to the graph-changing Hamiltonian. And since M is spatially diffeomorphismic invariant, which is not true for the Hamiltonian, you have to quantize it on the diffeomorphismic invariant Hilbert space. And so far, no, only kinematical coherent states are available. So there's work in progress by Bahr, Meusburger, and Thiemann, but still there are no coherent states on the diffeomorphismic invariant Hilbert space. So if I want to check the semi-classical limit of the graph-changing master constraint operator, I can do it. I can't do it. There's a second possibility to quantize the master constraint operator, which is graph non-changing. And this operator can then be defined on the kinematical Hilbert space of loop quantum gravity. Since we then have to use a quantization for the Hamiltonian, which is in the naive way anomalous, and we put the Hamiltonian enters the master constraint, we will somehow have to deal with these anomalies. And they occur in the sense that if you calculate the spectrum of the master constraint operator, the zero will not be contained in the spectrum, which is bad because it should be a constraint operator. So I want the zero to be in the spectrum. But there's a solution which was suggested by Dietrich and Thiemann. So if you calculate the spectrum and the minimal value of the spectrum is somehow of order h bar or higher orders of h bar, we could subtract it from the operator and define a new operator, m prime. And m prime and m, due to the h bar order, will still have the same semi-classical limit. You could interpret this a bit as a normal ordering for the harmonic oscillator, where you subtract also the ground state energy. And this occurred in the examples Bianca and Thomas investigated. And I think it was the SL2R case. Maybe Bianca can comment on this. And there they used this procedure and it worked. Another idea would be to improve the discretization of the Hamiltonian constraints in order to avoid anomalies at all. And there you could maybe look at techniques which are used in lattice QCD, for instance. They have similar problems, but still a much more simple Hamiltonian. So this is somehow work in progress to adopt some of their techniques also to the loop quantum gravity or algebraic quantum gravity approach. And another feature which is nice about the graph non-changing operator is that due to the weight function, you can now implement the infinitesimal diffuse in the quantum theory. So you somehow have a kind of democratic quantization of the Hamiltonian constraint and of the diffuse constraints. Yeah? Sorry? Okay, I want to comment on this later, but it's somehow just changing the labels of your graph. So if it acts, it will change the spin labels of your graph, but it will just add holonomies which are associated to edges which are already on your graph. Sorry? Yes, in loop quantum gravity, yes. Yeah? So it's not anymore that the graph is growing, like for the Hamiltonian. So you have a given graph, and it's just the dynamics would be just label changing. Sorry, so on the edges, in loop quantum gravity, I mean it's not, but in the algebraic framework, can I comment on this later? action. And another point I want to mention is that if I use the existing semi-classical tools, so I have a non-graph changing operator, which I could define on the kinematical Hilbert space of loop quantum gravity. And as Lee pointed out already, I can define it for each graph, but it's highly graph dependent. And also the existing semi-classical tools, I could either use these cutoff states, which are defined over a single graph, or I could use mixed states based on certain class of graphs, which was suggested by Bombelli and Winkler. But in both cases, I will never be able to consider all degrees of freedom of loop quantum gravity, which are encoded in all possible graphs, which I can embed into sigma. And then you could suggest, okay, let's sum over all possible graphs, but then I will run into problems because I will get non-normalizable states. So the existing semi-classical tools for my for the kinematic Hilbert space of loop quantum gravity are heavily graph dependent. And that's exactly motivation for the departure from loop quantum gravity to algebraic quantum gravity. So we discard the notion of embedded graphs, and we want to define a theory which is defined on one fundamental infinite orientated algebraic graph. And such a graph consists of a set, of a label set, yeah, of abstract points, which we would call vertices in loop quantum gravity. And it knows information how many abstract arrows, which we would call edges, between points are existing. What I lose if I go to the algebraic level is information like topology, the differential structure, and the spatial manifold sigma. The advantage is that an algebraic graph can be embedded in all possible ways into sigma. So only with the embedding I choose how these edges are related and what is short and what is, how the orientation between these edges is and so on. Since I take an infinite graph, I can embed it arbitrarily dense. So you could say that somehow the continuum limit is built in the theory. And fortunately, all physical diffeomorphism and invariant, and therefore embedding independent operators, can be lifted from loop quantum gravity to algebraic quantum gravity. So in introducing the algebraic framework, I've lost the graph dependence, since I have only one chosen algebraic graph, which is fundamental, or you could call maximal. Yes. Like for the diffeomorphism invariant Hilbert space.
Right, so this one you just take points and don't care.
No. This. I mean, if you have an infinite graph, you can choose an embedding where the edges are really close together. Yeah, because if you take the classical theory, you need to embed arbitrarily dense to, to go back to GR somehow.
Mm-hmm. So then, what is it? You shouldn't choose that type of independent.
No, you have. The philosophy is you have this theory, and then you give me a manifold or whatever, a topology and a differential structure. And I take this theory, which I define by the embedding as the semi-classical limit of my theory. And no, that's true, because okay, so you could think, so the dynamics are on the algebraic level, they will change the edges of my algebraic graph, and I could define a Hilbert space, and I could define spin network-like states in that Hilbert space. I mean, they're infinite, but similar structures. And then I could use like coefficients for the spin network state, which have some information about the topology and the manifold and the differential structure. And so I construct these coefficients, for instance, in like coherent states. So I take certain coefficients which have this information, and I have to put it in. That's maybe your criticism. It's not that you have to give me a manifold, a topology, and a differential structure, and then I can give you the coefficients. So whatever it's like, whatever I measure in the semi-classical limit, I could use coefficient which give me the right topology, the manifold, and the differential structure. No, I'm saying in the abstract Hilbert space, I can choose linear combinations of my spin network functions in that abstract space weighted by coefficients which have information about this, but I have to put it in. It's not that my, yeah, it's.
The Hilbert space and the states are completely embedded independent, but you can just.
Do you want a microphone?
I said the Hilbert space and all the states are completely embedding independent, but I can just choose to take coefficients, complex numbers, which are labeled, for example, by a topology, a differentiable structure, a three-dimensional manifold, a background metric, and all this stuff in order to build a state which does have a semi-classical interpretation. In other words, if you manage to do this, you can say that the theory has all semi-classical limits. I mean, and no. She will explain. She will tell you about recovery of dynamics.
So and, then on this algebraic graph, I can define a quantum, like quantum kinematics in algebra, which is very much inspired by loop quantum gravity, but actually it's a different one. And we have the following algebraic relations, which looks very much like the loop quantum gravity ones, but the difference is really that these are embedding independent quantities. So for instance, I wrote E of E and not E of S, which is in loop quantum gravity, because if I use surfaces, I need some information about the embedding to define a surface. So this is really quantities which are associated to the algebraic edges. So A is an element of a compact connected semi-simple Lie group, and E is an element of its associated Lie algebra. And if I consider representations of such an algebra, the natural representation is the infinite tensor product Hilbert space. And since we learned that for loop quantum gravity there is a uniqueness result, but which takes information about topology, differential structure, and so on, we are not, if we take this abstract algebra, we are not forced to these uniqueness results. So it's no contradiction I want to mention here. But we choose an Hilbert space, which is called the infinitesimal tensor product Hilbert space, and it's defined by the infinite tensor product of single Hilbert spaces associated to each edge. And the single Hilbert spaces are just L2 spaces over G with the harm as a measure d mu h. And as in loop quantum gravity, A and E act as multiplication and derivation operators, respectively. And this Hilbert space is spanned by vectors FE, and we only consider vectors which have a norm which is bigger than zero and also smaller than infinity, and the norm of such an infinite tensor product state is defined through the product of the single norms. And one can show that this Hilbert space decomposes into an uncountably infinitely sum of separable Hilbert spaces, which I will label with omega. And omega can, without loss of generality to be chosen to have the norm 1. And then each state in such a Hilbert space H omega can be constructed by acting with finite polynomials of E and A on omega. So omega is a kind of cyclic state for each Hilbert space. And if you compare this to the loop quantum gravity Hilbert space, you can say that it's the special case where you choose omega to be the infinite tensor product of ones. And then you add with a finite polynomial of A and E, and then you will get some excitations at the graph. So you could imagine you have this infinite graph and everywhere ones on it. And if you excite somehow only finite many edges, you have a graph, you have a state which also lives in the loop quantum gravity Hilbert space. The dynamics of the theory are given by just one single graph non-changing master constraint. That's how we defined it. And the infinitesimal diffuse and Hamiltonians are treated democratically. And as they act simply by label changing. Yeah? Can you use a microphone? Because it's.
I can speak up.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. But the problem is that you also want to have like flat space times. I mean, then you need like an infinite graph to consider like Minkowski. Onto a torus. Ah, okay, okay. Yeah, but so in this framework would be no problem to have quantum field theory on Minkowski space, which is quite successful. Yes. Yeah, but it's infrared problems. I mean,
it's something which is only a structure which is only required if you go to infinite gravity.
Okay, but you use this Hilbert space also in statistical mechanics, for instance, for spin chains or whatever, like infinite spin change. So it's not so exotic, maybe. And we have, I mean, the same, you also have a non-separable Hilbert space in loop quantum gravity. So it's. Yeah. Yeah, and the last point might be quite interesting to investigate further, because now you have a different acting of the Hamiltonian in the sense that it's not graph changing anymore, but it's label changing. So dynamics is just changing the spin labels, but you have the same action for the infinitesimal weighted diffeomorphism constraint. So these actions look really similar. And so if you understand the action of the Hamiltonian better in this framework, you maybe understand also the action of the diffuse in the infinitesimal version better. And yeah, let me summarize the main differences a bit. So for loop quantum gravity, I have to provide things like topology and the differential structure. And this is completely absent in the algebraic framework. The Hilbert spaces, which arise from the kinematical algebra, are different. In the case of loop quantum gravity, I have the Ashtekin, Meishan, Lewandowski Hilbert space. And for the algebraic framework, it's the infinite tensor product Hilbert space. Both Hilbert spaces are non-separable, but the separability has a very different origin. So in loop quantum gravity, I have finite graphs, which have separable Hilbert spaces, but then I have to sum over all possible graphs, and this sum is uncountably infinite, so I get a non-separable Hilbert space. And for the algebraic framework, I have an infinite tensor product Hilbert space, and if any of the small Hilbert spaces is at least two-dimensional, the resulting Hilbert space is automatically non-separable. And the graphs are embedded in the loop quantum gravity case, and we just have one fundamental graph in the algebraic case, which is algebraic. And the structure of the graphs is finite in loop quantum gravity and countably infinite in the algebraic framework. And the generating set of the SAR algebra is uncountably infinite because I have to find it on all possible graphs, and it's countably infinite for the algebraic theory because I just have to find it on the one fundamental graph. And since we are now in the situation that we can do semi-classical analysis, we have, if we provide the following data, like a three manifold, the initial data M, or equivalently a point in phase space, and an embedding of the graph into sigma, we can then construct coherent states on the level of the algebraic graph. And as I mentioned already, the data is only given in the coefficients. And this is a difference to loop quantum gravity, where you have coefficients which know something about the data, and you also have the spin network functions, which are defined on the embedded graph and know something about the data. So in algebraic quantum gravity, the loss of information about topology, differential structure, and sigma is encoded in the coherent states, in the semi-classical states. Yes? No, I mean, you can say you want Minkowski space-time to approximate, and then you can do this, but you could group.
Yeah, so, I mean, so now we care about labels. You want, I guess you call them A's and B's. Right?
Yeah. I think as long as a semi-connected V-group. Yeah. What's what? SMF. Spin network function, sorry. Is it wrong? So what do you use usually?
It's so what you mean is that you have an expansion, a state expansion over different labels on your one graph. And the coefficients of the expansion are going to refer in some way to a choice of the d-dimensional manifold and then the d-dimensional manifold.
Yes. I mean, yeah, you define coherent states similar to the case of loop quantum gravity. The only thing is that, I mean, it's also there, it's a linear combination of spin network states. But the only difference is that you define the states here on the algebraic level. So they live on the algebraic graph, and in loop quantum gravity, it's the same construction like the complexifier method we use for coherent states. But then you have a linear combination of spin network states which are embedded. So if you replace like the spin net. No. Yes, but the question is it coherent for what you want to approximate? And I doubt this. I mean. For the coherent, yes, because I mean I want to approximate a certain theory. And I need that my holonomies and whatever are well approximated. And if I choose like different coefficients, I guess I will run into problems with the semi-classical approximation. Because I mean you define your semi-classical states for a given operator such that they approximate this operator well, that the fluctuations are small. And if you mix the data, I guess you will run into problems with this. And even in loop quantum gravity, we cannot define these semi-classical states. We have to define them for a certain class of operators. So for instance, I could use some which approximate, or even in usual quantum mechanics, which approximate the Hamiltonian well. But if I exponentiate the Hamiltonian, it's not a well approximation anymore. And even for powers, like high powers, the approximation gets worse. So what we did then, we choose a cubic graph, which is six-valent at each vertex. And since we have the freedom to do not excite certain edges at each vertex, we also you could use the calculation also for 4- and 5-valent vertices, just by not exciting two or one edges at each vertex. And we thought 6 is already quite complicated, so we should start with something. And another simplification, or a simplification we did is we substituted U1 cubed by for SU2. And I will explain in the third part where I talk about semi-classical perturbation theory, that it's really justified for these semi-classical calculations. And just to demonstrate, that's how the algebraic master constraint operator looks defined on an algebraic graph. And I mean, the details are not so important, but what I wanted to say about this is that this is basically the Hamiltonian constraint, which enters in the squared version here. And this is the diffeomorphism constraint, the infinitesimals. And apart from all the summations, you really see that they look quite similar in this framework. The only difference is that you have another internal summation here over the epsilons. And this will look similar for SU2. This is now the U1 cube case. And don't worry about all the indices. This is just to write it in a quite compact form for the cubic graph. And the result which we got when we calculated each single contribution of the vertex operator and summed over all vertices is something which you could, or which you can interpret as the classical master constraint operator discretized on a cubic lattice. And then in a second step, you can remove the lattice in the sense that you shrink epsilon to zero. And then we indeed end up with the continuum expression of the master constraint operator. So with this calculation, we have shown that if we consider the dynamics of algebraic quantum gravity on the left-hand side here, we end up with at least the correct infinitesimal generators of general relativity. And whenever you do this semi-classical calculation, you will get some quantum corrections. And for this calculation, we only were interested in the fact whether they are finite or not. So at some point, maybe you should get some predictions out of these quantum corrections. But for this work, since we, for instance, substituted U1 cubed for SU2, we were, and the corrections, I guess, or I'm guessing that the exact number of the corrections will depend whether you use U1 cubed or SU2. The only thing which we were interested in is that it's finite, and this will survive for SU2 as well, as I will explain later. And why didn't we do it for SU2? I want to explain this in the third part of my talk. And the problem is, if you calculate within SU2, the master constraint operator expectation value will look something like this. So you have the commutator, and you have in the master constraint the squared volume operator. But even if you consider something like the Hamiltonian constraint, you will have the volume here. And since for SU2, this is a really complicated operator, you can't calculate this analytically. So formally, let me write such a matrix element in this form. And for the master constraint operator, then it's specialized to this function f. This is the volume operator, also on the algebraic level, given in terms of the E's here. And I define then the thing with inside the absolute value as an operator Q, just to make it easier with the notation. And then V is just the fourth root out of Q squared. And if you consider the square root of Q, it's of course just 1/8 here. And the problem is that it's quite complicated to calculate such quantities. And since there will be a lot of formulas in the following slides, I decided to light everything red, which we cannot calculate, and everything green, which we can calculate. So if you get lost at some point, you can remember that when I have managed to express the red quantities in terms of green quantities, I'm done, and I'm happy, and I can start to calculate. So the naive idea would be, okay, let's define a quantity that which is computable, which is defined like this. And this operator is bounded from below by -1. If this is zero, and it's bigger if this is non-zero. And Winkler and Thiemann have showed in their SU2 coherent states calculation that this can be calculated exactly. At least Q can be calculated exactly, and then, of course, also Q squared, because I can insert a 1, because coherent states fulfill a resolution of identity. And then the idea is to express my function fi of v in terms of these x. And I can then I get a factor here, which is the expectation value of Q times to the qi power times 2. And this I can calculate here, so I can also calculate the power of 2q of it. And the thing which is not computable is moved to this function fi here, which is given by this. And then the idea is to say, okay, don't worry about the definition, the interval where this function is defined, just expand it like this. Use the Taylor expansion. And then use the spectral theory, which tells me what how a function of an operator is related to the function of the eigenvalues. And then I expand the function here and use it's the so-called spectral resolution of the operator. So I use the it's an operator identity. So the function of xi is given by this expression. And any powers of xi are computable by the methods developed by Winkler and Thiemann. And of course, we know that this infinite sum here will only converge if t lies in the interval minus 1 plus 1. So we already know that this won't work. So the naive idea won't work and must be substituted by a rigorous argument. And I demonstrated the naive idea here quite in detail, because actually we will use this expansion. And because you can show that for each k, you can find a better k, which is between 0 and infinity, such that the function which you can't compute can be sandwiched between two quantities which you can compute. And I called them f minus here and f plus. So, and this f2k plus 1 is basically the expansion of the sum up to 2k plus 1 order, and the same here. And of course, we are only interested in q being bigger than 0 and 1/4, because for 1 over 4, it's just v equal to square root of q squared. And then the idea is to use the polarization identity, which is written here just for the real part. We can write such a matrix element like this. And so we have a difference of two terms here. And then the idea is, okay, here I have a positive term. So if I put in here the thing which is smaller than my f, it will be lower. It will be smaller than the real quantity. And if I subtract something which is bigger, it will definitely be smaller than the real quantity. So if I plug in here the f minus and here the f plus, this will definitely be smaller than the thing which I want to calculate. And the same for if I interchange f plus and f minus, I will get some. So this will be smaller, and this will become bigger. So this will be definitely bigger or equal to the thing which I cannot calculate. So the idea is now somehow to iterate this procedure. So imagine we have such an expectation value to calculate. Then we will use this expansion. So we can write this as something which is calculable. These are just holonomies. And some sum of the other matrix element which are not computable because the f enters. And then for each of the matrix elements, you will use the estimation from the slide before and iterate this. And what turns out is that exactly this quantity which is not computable can be expressed in terms of computable quantities up to order of h bar k plus 1 corrections. So the x operator squared has an order of h bar. And if I expand it, I want my correction to be of at least one order higher. So I have to go to the order 2k plus 1. That's the idea. So why does this justify that I can replace U1 cubed by SU2? So this calculation shows whenever I have a matrix element like this here, an expectation value, I can replace V by this expression here. And then I get a lot of terms which I can calculate. And the SU2 calculations of Winkler and Thiemann have shown that the zeroth order of the holonomy and the flux operator is well approximated by the classical quantities. So roughly speaking, if I have something like this here, I could insert a one of coherent states here. And then for each of these terms, I will get something like the classical value plus quantum corrections. So there will be at least one term where I take all the lowest order contributions, which is the classical term. And if I do this for U1 cube and SU2, one can show that it's exactly the same result just by resubstituting the quantities of U1 cube of the SU2 quantities. So with these calculations, we can indeed conclude that the zeroth order would be the correct one in SU2 as well. We don't know about the corrections because it's just an estimation. So I'm sure they will be different. That's why we don't predict anything with our quantum corrections we get. So let me finally conclude. Algebraic quantum gravity provides a platform to analyze the dynamics of the theory semi-classical. The dynamics of the algebraic quantum gravity theory are driven by the rough non-changing master constraint operator. And in leading order, the semi-classical limit reproduces the correct infinitesimal generators of general relativity. The quantum fluctuations are finite, which could be shown by semi-classical perturbation theory. And the correct value of the fluctuations in SU2, this is work in progress by Johannes Brunemann. And there are lots of open questions. One is, for instance, I have now infinitesimal diffeomorphism generators. So these should be somehow be related to the infinite to the finite diffeomorphisms in an embedding in an embedded theory. And so far, so if I exponentiate these somehow and embed them, they should be somehow related to the usual diffeomorphisms. And we don't know this yet. Another problem is that the exact kernel of M could be empty. This means that the zero is not in the spectrum. Then, as I mentioned, you could subtract the minimal value and define a new operator, which hopefully has the same semi-classical limit. Or you could improve the discretization, which I would favor more. But I mentioned there are some techniques in lattice QCD, but since the master constraint is much more complicated than a lattice QCD Hamiltonian, this is quite hard to adopt. So this is work in progress. And the same is, or you should understand the non-graph changing action of the infinitesimal metal operators better in order to understand what dynamics is. Thank you for your attention.
Do we have more questions?
So there are lots of questions in this. It's a new direction, so there could be many questions.
Let me ask you just some physical question to the lattice gauge theories.
Since you start with the choose any graph, say hypercubic graph, and you have a semi-classical, you have semi-classical space, at what order in your perturbation theory will you see a breakdown of rotational invariance because you see the structure of the lattice?
Yeah, already at the first order, I guess. I mean, you mean in the quantum fluctuations, or?
Right. So presumably, the fact that you chose a hypercubic lattice should show up in a lack of rotational invariance.
You mean that the diffeomorphism algebra has anomalies in the quantum theory?
No, I don't mean that. I hope there are no anomalies. I mean that if I study the interaction or the propagation of long wavelength excitations of some wavelength lambda, then there might be effects of order of L Planck over lambda that are not rotational invariant because you, an experimentalist, could detect the fact that your theory was based on a hypercubic graph which is not rotationally invariant. not necessarily bad if that's true, but...
I mean, for if it's not embedded, I can answer because, I mean, then... But for... The problem is a bit, I mean, the corrections look really... So somehow I should write them again in a, like a spatial integral or whatever to interpret something out of the quantities.
However you do it, I mean, however you do it is up to you, but in lattice gauge theory, what typically happens is that rotational invariance is restored at long wavelengths compared to the lattice scale, which I presume is now. Right, but the claim is that the semi-classical states depend on an embedding.
Mm-hmm.
And we're looking for Planck scale quantum gravity effects. And so I'm using this as an example as a way of asking, okay, is there a way that you can compute some observables if you have a semi-classical, an expansion around a semi-classical state, which could see the nature of the graph that you chose? And this is not necessarily bad, because these might be some quantities of interest.
I wouldn't know in which, I mean the, so what we calculated is just the next to leading order, and this, so I wouldn't know where you could see this there, but I don't know if you go to higher.
Well, there
okay, so there are two comments. First, you can further improve this calculation because we have just taken a pure state. As it turns out, if you use a statistical average over embeddings, you can improve, for example, things like rotational invariance. So this is something that you can do. This is quite similar as the work by Luca Bombelli and Oliver Winkler. So this is one thing. If you're dealing with the pure states, then in fact you see that there is something along the lines that you have indicated, namely that there is a long wavelength restored of rotational invariance. So there's a certain length scale which has to do something with the scale of the graph as it is embedded and compared to the background that you're dealing with, and the fundamental length scale, which is the Planck scale. So that there's a ratio epsilon over LP, which comes up.
Let me try to compare what you're doing to a much more simple model from quantum mechanics. So let's look at the harmonic oscillator, and there are the well-known coherent states. So these are these nicely bell-shaped states with a nice position and momentum, nicely peaked. So what you can do is you can calculate the expectation value of some operator using those states. And what you will get is you will find something very close to the classical value of that operator. And if you just look at the harmonic oscillator, these coherent states are actually semi-classical states in the sense that the evolution doesn't disturb this behavior of them, right? Which is sort of, I guess, one of the reasons why people look at these things and think that they sort of have classical properties. But that thing sort of goes. There's a problem if you think that if you now say go to the anharmonic oscillator, just sort of as a simple example. So it's still a nicely peaked state. But it's not semi-classical in the sense that it always has this thing. So what I really want, what I would really like to call a semi-classical state, is something that has this property that it stays semi-classical through the time evolution, if you want. So the states that you start with, I think, I mean, shouldn't I see them as the things that are where I take the harmonic oscillator coherent states, which is what you, so that I take those, and calculate expectation value with these things. But there's no reason for me to expect that they will be good in the sense that they will be actual semi-classical states.
You mean actually in the sense that they are preserved by the dynamics?
Yes, that there's something semi-classically preserved by that. So your calculation is great, right? Because it shows, okay, this operator is not is a good candidate at least. But what I want is I want the real state, which is the thing that stays semi-classical. But and it's that state that I need to calculate what really a quantum gravity effect would be, because the other one, it's very hard to disentangle what's an actual effect and what's an artifact of my funny choice of state, right? You could choose any state that is sort of nicely peaked, doesn't have to be that coherent state, and you will find a dependence on that choice in your perturbation theory.
Okay, two comments. One is that even in usual field theory, if the Hamiltonian is not harmonic oscillator, like you don't have semi-classical states which are preserved for all times. So it's not available even in simpler systems. And the second one is I have to check these on the kinematical Hilbert space because it's a constraint which vanishes on the physical Hilbert space. But I agree concerning other things. I would really like the states to be preserved under the dynamics. But even, I mean, our master or Hamiltonian, whatever you think, is much more complicated. It's even not polynomial. So.
Right, but doesn't the problem still remain that you still that the ultimate physics is in the two things. You need to get the whole thing.
No. The two things have absolutely nothing to do with each other. I mean, the one thing is to check whether the operator has the correct classical limit. This can be done only at the kinematical level. Point one. The second thing is you want to have states which are semi-classical with respect to some physical evolution. That physical evolution has absolutely nothing to do with the Master constraint or any Hamiltonian constraint. So that's the second step.
That's where sort of the quantum gravity physics is, isn't it?
Well, you're overtaking a little bit the historical thing, because I mean we didn't have any possibility to do any calculations and do anything or say anything convincing about the implementation of the dynamics. That was our concern here. What you're interested in is physical applications and semi-classical states which are preserved under Hamiltonian evolution.
Right.
That is the second step.
Okay, so there's no that you, that's, you that, that's what you want to do.
Yeah. This is something we want to do in the future.
We just want to say that.
But it will not invalidate what we have done.
No. I'm just trying to. Okay. So then.
I mean, this calculation shows that if you take the constraint operator, which has to be defined on the kinematical Hilbert space, it has the exact semi-classical limit, so it might be a good candidate to evolve the physical evolution and whatever. I mean, this is just nothing more and nothing less.
Okay.
I
now have to sort of go through the argument. How you then use the perturbation theory? Then you have to go back and find the right state that sort of annihilates that or something like that. I mean, it's sort of.
Or you can
tricky,
say it's semi-classical perturbation theory within kinematical semi-classical states. Because even for this, you will have different h-bar corrections, and I could be interested in them. I mean, I don't say we predict anything with these corrections. I just want.
I'm trying to understand what is it that you have to do to actually get a prediction.
Sorry.
What is it that you actually have to? I'm trying to sort of understand what is it that you have to do so that you actually get a prediction. That's what I'm sort of trying to understand.
You mean why I get a correction at all?
No. So what is it that? So how do you use that to? What are the missing steps or the steps that you do that you need to do to now get a prediction at the end? Where you say this is a prediction of my theory. That's what I'm trying to understand.
A physical prediction.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean a physical prediction for a constraint operator or.
Why for your theory?
Mm-hmm. You mean in terms of Feynman diagrams and...
I can say something. If you, okay, so the missing steps is, of course, you have to have sufficient control on the physical states, so physical states which are annihilated by the operator. Then you have to supply a physical Hamiltonian with respect to which you can calculate scattering amplitudes. So this can be done, for example, in the relational framework that Yuto Kalo and Bianca. And, well, you have to come up as a physical Hamiltonian. I gave a talk on this 2 days ago. You have to still quantize this expression. But in principle, the conceptual framework is crystal clear.
Other stuff is starting at 2. And thanks for your attention. Thank you.